Welcome to another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. Today, my guest is Dr. Kobe Lyons again. Great to have you back on the show, Kobe.
Thanks for having me back. It's an honor to be back. Feels like just yesterday we were having a conversation.
Today we're going to talk a bit about Copilot and a bit about some of the movements in the AI space in Australia. We're just going to have a chat about that. So I was reading the Commonwealth Government's, the Australian Government Trial of Microsoft Copilot report, and I was sharing that with Kobe earlier, and I thought that might be interesting to actually have a chat about.
As you do, as one reads these reports just for fun, Kate, what did you find? What did you find most interesting about it?
I thought the really interesting thing was that it was pretty positive, overwhelmingly positive, but not overall positive. So there were some things that people said were not as effective as other tools. So that was particularly around coding. So the thing people seem to love, and this seems to be really consistent with my experience at UNSW, they love the meeting notes.
Everyone loves fewer meetings and the ability to not have to attend all the meetings.
That is the thing that everybody loves. A lot of people say it's more product makes them more productive. Hilariously, it was people in the senior executive service and corporate roles that found that they got a lot of productivity benefits. So we don't know, and I probably need to delve into it a bit more to find what happens with the frontline associates, so the people who are actually dealing with customers, and what if they were included or if they had a good experience. So I don't know what their experience was, but overwhelming, senior executive service and corporate services, overwhelmingly positive feedback.
So that makes me think of also rolling out Copilot in a large organization. And just recently, I was reading the Thesis Whisperer, who in the academic circles has been gushing about the benefits of Copilot, particularly for these kinds of things, taking minutes, not having to attend meetings, attending multiple meetings was one of the pitches we had from Microsoft about using Copilot. But then I also wonder about some of the non-verbal relationship building stuff that happens in those meetings, particularly when they're in person and you're sort of having those conversations that then. It sort of comes back to what is productivity, and then also how those people, most of these reports are self-reporting, at least the ones I've seen. Is that the same for this report as well?
So it's the government assessing their own
Their
experience.
own stuff.
They did it as a proper pilot. They did survey. They've got charts in the report. So it's a really nice summary though. And it's funny because, and I'll put the links to both of these in the show notes for people, because there is another article that I've been sharing as part of my AI for Organizational Innovation course that I'm delivering at Australian Graduate School of Management at the moment, which is by Microsoft, which is What Can Copilot's Earliest Users Teach Us About Generative AI at Work? And it's a first look at impact on productivity, creativity, and time. And because Microsoft wrote it, obviously, it's overwhelmingly positive. And in my last class, people were saying, well, we might take that with a grain of salt. So I think this Australian government
Skepticism.
one will be better for people to have a look at and get a real feel for what it looks like across a very large organisation.
There is some interesting, slightly more independent research from the Boston Consulting Group around, and I remember I used some of this in my trainings as well, that the benefits vary vastly, to your point, depending on what roles people have. So people who have more access to more information. I mean, it's really obvious when you say it, but they're going to have more benefit from a tool like this that can skate across and collate and curate what they can access already. But someone who's more junior or frontline or has limited access is probably going to get less benefit. But that said, for more junior staff who are not as competent, or I mean, I'm assuming that junior people are less competent. Let's reframe that. For people who are less competent at writing generally, they're going to get more benefit out of these tools because they're great for a first throwdown and then you can go through and review them. But for those who are really good writers or think by writing, they're not getting as much benefit out of these tools. So there's a whole lot of research on those sorts of connections. And then the wonderful sort of sidebar of people worried about losing jobs are going to start putting documents not on Teams and shared sites because, particularly for lawyers who have precedents or other kind of documents they don't want to share and they want to keep their value in the workplace, they will game some of these tools as well, which I also looked at in terms of a side effect of some of the tools being used. But, I look at it from more the red teaming, what are people going to do? That's less expected, or how are people going to be changing behaviours?
And that is one of the interesting things, because corporates are overwhelmingly on Microsoft. You know, they use Microsoft Office. They've all migrated to the cloud version of that product. But now with Copilot baked in, whether you want it or not, it starts to really raise questions for organizations that have needs, like lawyers. And I know a lot of law firms have been exploring developing their own internal custom large language.
And many of them are already, yeah.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in future. But yeah, so it was an interesting piece of work. But tell us what's happening in the AI space in Australia. There were some government movements recently, weren't there?
Yeah, so the National AI Centre has moved into under the Department of Science and Research into DISA. And the interesting thing about that is that it's now becoming operationalized. So there are some large sources of funding that are being distributed to various corporations that are going to be AI enabling. It's more AI enabling, it seems, than AI management and governance. And I make that distinction because I think there's to your point about certain framing of messages, I think there's still a push for Australia to uptake AI and to use it more, which I don't disagree with. I would just say I would add the and of it needs to be managed and used in a sensible way. So it's going to be interesting to see as those centres roll out their work, what they're offering. I ran a workshop for Standards Australia in Sydney a couple of weeks ago, and I think one of the questions I'm getting at just about everywhere I present now is how do small and medium enterprises even start to engage with managing and governing AI? And there's a real gap in that space because the large corporations can tack an AI person onto their privacy team or in their tech team, and they're starting to do that. Some are starting to hire chief AI officers. But for the small to medium enterprises, they really are going to need a resource where they can either have services and products pre-approved or at least have some kind of uplift or skills provided to help them do that. There's a massive gap there, I think.
I was literally talking with Gladwin Mendes, who's a well-known chief data officer in Australia and New Zealand, yesterday about this. And he's actually set up a new business for fractional chief data officers. And I think
Brilliant.
that's the way of the future, because he was saying the same thing. All of these big corporations can do it themselves, but all these smaller corporations, they need the support. And they probably need more fractional support from more roles, but they don't need it full time.
There are two pieces to that. I think, firstly, they don't, even the larger corporations don't necessarily need someone full time for two reasons. One, and these are the two parts. One is, there aren't enough of us to go around to do the work. So some of us have been doing this work for a long time and know how it needs to be done. There just aren't enough of us. We're going to have to uplift and train, and that's going to take a little while. The other piece is you don't really need someone full time because you actually need to do it incrementally and do some internal work. So you can actually have someone come and help you. You go do the work internally and then step out and come back. And I'm seeing that with a lot of companies that want policies created. Okay, you've got your policy created. That's been settled with your execs and your board, and everyone's got buy-in. You've socialized it. Then you need your processes. So that's another step. And in between, you don't necessarily need someone full-time shepherding that. That needs to be driven, at the highest levels. So then you can duck and weave and provide a lot of assistance without being there full-time, I think. I think he's really onto something.
So, it's really interesting that he's identified that gap in the market, and I think that's going to be a growing area for the future. Well, the other thing is just the training that people are going to need. So I've been having a lot of conversations with organizations, and they're even struggling to grapple with just the basic AI literacy programs. Like UNSW solved it pretty easily because they're used to teaching. So they had a new online course for staff up and done pretty quickly. But other organizations that don't teach as a business, they're really struggling with this. How do we get just a basic level of AI literacy across our entire workforce? Then how do we then work out what skills our technical people need and what skills our business people need to build? So, there's going to be a lot of training needed across the entire workforce.
Yes, and translational work. So I think, again, back to the chief AI officer point, there are starting to be full-time chief AI officer roles because I'm watching the space fairly closely. And a lot of them are technical. They're looking for people who can build AI and ML and also govern and also educate and. They're different skill sets and different
Unicorns, they're unicorns.
framings. Well, yeah, I think being able to do translational
Hardly
work.
anyone else can do that. So hardly anyone else has actually the governance, management, and the technology and architecture skills. Like I can do that because I'm very old and I've been working across data for a really long
You're
time.
also amazing. But yes.
But finding that in one person is exceptionally rare, and they're going to need more than one, is what I'm saying. More than one person.
And I think that educational piece, again, you can't do one that fit one size fits all. So the trainings that I do with data scientists are very different to the trainings that I do with lawyers. This week I gave a presentation to the Victorian Comprehensive Cancer Alliance, which is very different, again, talking to medical professionals to think about what kinds of automation AI could be used and what things to think about. There's an industry specific angle and an ability to sort of be able to draw lines and learn lessons from others that I think is really important. On that note, I'm going to do a shout out for Kendra Vant, who has a Substack. She just wrote, it's called, I think it's called Data Runs Deep. I'll put the link in the show notes. She made a point today in her blog, which I thought is brilliant and I haven't seen in many places. When you hire someone to do this work, let them speak publicly about it, including the red teaming and the things that go wrong and you didn't do. And there are two benefits to that. One is that you're actually showing that you're thoughtful and you're mindful. But the other, as she raises, is you're going to attract others who want to do similar kinds of work with responsible organizations. So don't just tell your customers and the broader public what you've done right. If you've stopped something going through or you've had some kind of system that you've reviewed and gone, oh, that's a bad idea. I've heard of a couple of funny examples this week that I can't share, but definitely share those. Share them with the public and also let others learn because that's how the uplift is going to occur when others hear that other companies are stopping doing things. So I thought that was a really excellent point that I'll definitely weave into my trainings going forward as well.
Yeah, and like I know that Australian National University, when they had their big cyber breach, were very open about it and shared a lot, particularly across the higher ed sector. And it was the first time any organisation in higher ed had really done that. And we all got real value from finding out what had happened and how it had happened. And it really helped to uplift our knowledge of cyber breaches. So, I can't imagine why it wouldn't work in the AI space as well.
100%. I think also for people to understand tolerances, and I've really enjoyed the workshop with Standards Australia for the case studies. People got really into the case studies and had different views and had different opinions. And in that particular piece, each table had different C-suite and a vendor, so it was as realistic as it possibly could be to sort of say, what are your interests here? What questions would you want to be asking? What would you need to be thinking about? In that case, it was to align with the ISO standard, but even just thinking about aligning with your own processes without the ISO standard and managing risk internally, that's a really helpful framing. But I think people are hungry. Sense I get is that people are hungry now for practical applications. They've tried their POCs, they've done their Copilot trial, or they've heard about someone else's Copilot trial, and what they want now is really concrete guidance on how to embed policies, process, and the people cultural piece as well, which is often forgotten in how to manage these systems going forward.
Yeah, and I think the hardware vendor example that I've used extensively, where they did a pilot last year. So this time last year, they turned on a pilot, and a couple of weeks later, they turned off their pilot because it had surfaced so much confidential information, and the thing that made them close it down was somebody was able to discover a spreadsheet with everybody's bonus, which didn't go down well, to be honest. So that pilot got shut down pretty quickly. But I was having a chat with Microsoft, some of their senior folks from Seattle, about that, about this time last year. And they were just saying their baseline assumption is that every organization has its information and data governance sorted. So that's
Some
their
maniacal
baseline.
laugh.
Like they've released everything and gone, we think you'll be fine, because you've got this sorted. And increasingly, it's obvious to me that many organizations have not even started on this journey. So I'm running a data governance for leaders course at AGSM. And the number of people that are coming saying, how do we start? How do we get started with data governance? So they're not even looking at AI governance. They're just saying, how do we do data governance?
And that's where you start. So this is where our work ducks and weaves is that people come and say, I want to use AI or I'm using AI or, I've thought about doing something. And the place you start every time is your work. It's data governance. It's how much do you have lined up internally. And also And this was also in Kendra's blog today. You can't run a POC with a few things sort of held together with blue tack and sticky tape and then go, we can roll this out wholesale. If you haven't sorted your data governance to begin with and you haven't got ongoing processes to go to do that, your AI is going to be not very good and potentially harmful and not give you the value for the money.
So that's an interesting thing, because one of the things that I'm talking about when I'm doing a lot of public speaking these days is just having an agreed pipeline from proof of concept to pilot to production, and to have the right stage gates and the right approvals, so that you have a systematic process for saying, yeah, this POC was good, it's good to go, now it can go into pilot, now it's good to go, and now it can go into production. And then to have your ongoing assessment. And the thing that I'm telling people now is AI is buying a puppy. Like, it's not like in the old days where you'd implement a CRM or some kind of accounting system and you'd leave it. You would just leave that thing alone until you did the next upgrade. AI needs to be tweaked and adjusted on a regular basis. Otherwise, it will drift. You'll have model drift, and your answers can be egregiously wrong in a very, very short time. So, it's like buying a puppy. You've got to feed the puppy, and people are not understanding this. So it's always a bit of a shock to them when they realize what AI doesn't just sit there and run properly forever. It needs to be tweaked.
Yeah, I've got a puppy wandering past. Puppies also require puppy school and socializing and connecting with other puppies. I mean, that analogy could go on and on and on. IEEE's got some really good frameworks around procurement. I don't know if you've seen those. They have very specific requirements for procurement that can be really helpful. The ISO standard is more about the AI management over the life cycle, but both of those require ongoing review. So to your point, you absolutely can't just acquire and forget, but also you attach things to other things, to use the analogy of the puppy school. Like these puppies are going to play with other puppies, and you want to make sure they're not biting and they're not doing things they shouldn't be doing, even if they're teething. The other thing is definitions. I've seen POCs and pilots used as terms just to get things over the line when they're on a scale that they're clearly not either of those. So having definitions internally in your policies that say a POC is this size group for this period of time, pilots this. Real world is this is really important so that people also don't game just getting things out into the wild by saying it's a POC or a pilot. So that's where your policies come in. So all of those pieces are in interplay with if you don't have the policies without the processes and you don't have people trained. And this is probably the biggest thing. A friend of mine was at a barrister's talk this week. Sean Brady was talking and she was so excited where she sort of said, oh, look, he was talking about how systems, law is like a system and other things are like a system. And we as lawyers always look at that end result when actually it's the whole system interacting. And she said, this is stuff you've been saying for years. And I said, yes, it is. But she said, the other thing you talked about was culture. One of the biggest past pieces of this and one of the hardest pieces is actually having a culture where people feel safe to call stuff out.
And that feeling of psychological safety is so important to start thinking about consciously developing across your organization. You can even do it in your own little pocket, that it can be safe in your own team, even though the rest of the organization might be slightly toxic. You can literally build that kind of culture. But it's so important, because there are often very early warning signs that get ignored, and we're going to have plenty of case studies.
Oh yeah, they're already starting to happen. I mean, the other thing was she said they use Boeing as an example, and again, lawyers look at the fault of the what's happened with Boeing, but in effect, that was a cultural piece, right? Boeing's board always had engineers; they always had safety first, and then they very, very rapidly removed a number of those sort of safety perspectives. And so, in addition to,
Focused people,
sorry,
pesky safety focused people.
yeah.
They were very much a sales oriented board.
They then got completely they turfed them, but that goes again to your processes. You want to have carrots and sticks for all of these issues. You can't just go, I've got this policy that floats alone in the corporate ecosystem, and I hope someone pays attention to it. Unless your policy is embedded as a in your conduct, your code of conduct, if something goes wrong, and unless it's in the KPIs of your execs to get rewarded when it goes right, there's no incentive for people to change. So, or there's less incentive for people to change. I shouldn't say there's none.
Is just having implemented data governance and been part of the re recent revamp of it at UNSW. The important thing is that once you've released it, there's an ongoing need for comms forever. Like, it's like painting a harbour bridge. As soon as you finish, you start again. And so, like, we used to sit down every year and work out a proper comms schedule because you get new people in the organization, people new roles, and the organizational memory of practice can very quickly dissipate if you're not always communicating about it.
Yep. And you reach different levels of maturity as well. You want to be uplifting and encouraging and bringing others along. Yeah, the ongoing nature of it is really important, and I think that's probably one of the biggest things that the standard will be encouraging for those who are complying with the ISO standard, but just generally as good practice in your business, with or without the standard. The thing that I keep coming back to is if you don't do this well, it's going to cost you a lot of money, both in terms of the tools that you're buying that won't serve their purpose, and also in reputational harm, potentially even, fines and litigation.
Well,
You want to
and
get
for
it right.
organizations, it can have real harm to real people. So, like the Boeing example, planes fell out of the sky. So organize might not be that serious, but people can be harmed. Look at Robodebt. People were significantly harmed by Robodebt, which wasn't AI. I just want to make that point. But
Excel spreadsheet. Yes.
And this is the other part of the problem. People are it's there's a lot of snake oil salespeople around at the moment with AI who are trying to sell solutions that are just rubbish, that are underpinned by a spreadsheet or, are somebody told me the other day about one that was a control F in a Word document.
Wow. Imagine paying for that. I think circling back to the thesis whisperer, what I was trying to sort of say at the beginning is also when you come back to your problem statement, is your problem that you need to be able to attend more meetings? And I've been in these jobs, right? I've had these jobs where you've got back to backs from international time zones from 8 till 7 at night. Maybe we just need fewer meetings and other ways of managing work. Maybe we need, I know that's an outrageous thing to say, but maybe the problem isn't.
Could this meeting be an email?
Could this meeting be a to-do list and people actually do the work? I'm not saying I love meetings. I love a good meeting when it's got an agenda and it's got an outcome. I'm all over it. But a lot of our business practices are quite poor, and the AI is not going to fix that, just like a lot of the HR tools that are coming out in AI are not going to fix your cultural problems.
This goes to my other thing, which is email. If we're using generative AI to fix our email, and if
Oy,
I'm using generative AI to write my email and I'm not reading the substance of your
yeah,
email,
and I'm using mine to read yours.
what
Yep.
is the purpose of that communication? How might that communication be different? Because if AI can read it and AI can write it and we're not really participating in that communication, how real is that communication? And I think this is going to cause us, well, sensible people will start to think about these things and think about how can we do. Because the purpose of email is communication. So how can we undertake the communication task more effectively? Because, email's ancient technology. It's from the 70s. And, there were some attempts to make it go away by Google. If you remember, Google had a stab at it. But,
Yes, I do.
a lot of people are very wedded to email, but it's probably the most inefficient form of communication.
Yeah, there's a. I didn't like me on the podcast because it was 3 in the morning and I don't really remember much of it, but I interviewed Emily Bender, who I fangirl very, very deeply on a Carnegie and Equality podcast. Emily's been doing this work forever and she talks about the symbol and the meaning, right? So what generative AI is doing is capturing the symbols, but it's not the meaning behind it. And we all know. Again, those of us who are older pick up the phone. There are times where I'll pick up an electric telephone because once it gets past a certain number of texts or emails, you're like, this is not really what should be happening here. I just need to have a conversation. So again, going back to your business practices, and I think one of my favorite ads while I was at Bupa was actually about how to have fewer meetings. It was like, here's Bob. Bob has too many meetings. He called it out and they showed how culturally you should do that. But again, creating those spaces for people to go, is the issue really that I want to be watching all of these meetings at quadruple speed, which, a lot of kids do with lectures as well. This is a thing that's we're kind of in digesting information differently. But should we be presenting the information differently? Because if it's that boring that you need to watch it at 4 speed, you're probably not doing it right.
Well, people have different minds. Like my mind likes to consume data fast, and I find a lot of people very slow. So if I can watch a video of them at 2 times speed, it's actually at a good speed for me. Real life's a bit slow for me. Just saying.
Yeah, I think we're quite similar. I had complaints at Melbourne Uni when I recorded lectures because I speak so quickly that people couldn't watch at double speed. So there were complaints that I needed to speak more slowly. I'm like, no, just watch me on single speed. This is how my brain works. Sorry, can't fix that.
So yeah, but probably what's going to happen in the world is, because there's advances happening in the world of science and medicine that are starting to understand different brains. And I think one of the outcomes of this is we're going to understand that there is no one normal brain. We've had this idea there's a normal brain and then there's the neurodivergent brain, but I think we're going to discover there are all neurodivergent brains, they're all just different.
Ranges of ways of thinking, and that way, those ways of working will work for some and not for others. I really enjoy the work that I'm doing with boards and execs to really drill down on what steps they can take for all of these pieces. I just think there's so much work to be done in this space, and there's so many people who are hungry for more information about how to do it better. They don't want the negatives, but they also want to be not buying tools that are control F functions underneath. There's just, yeah, there's We're going to need an enormous amount of training to uplift not just consultants, but also people educationally are going to need to have more work done. UNSW is doing some great work in this space, but they're going to need to be some serious changes across universities to be able to respond to this.
Yeah, well, it, there are times when it's just really handy having an entire organization that teaches and can turn around new courses really fast. But I just look out there at all the organizations that don't have that capability and don't also often have the funding to go and pay for these courses, because a lot of courses that you can go and buy, if you have to educate your entire workforce, that becomes quite an expensive proposition. So, and the question is, does it need to be face to face? Probably not. And really, there's some quite good learning online out there available for free already from a lot of the big vendors. But one thing that I've detected, and it's come up in conversations with a number of CIOs recently, is they've all made the big push to cloud, and they're typically on one of the three big clouds. And they're starting to get their price sticker shock now. And they're starting to realize that everything they do in the cloud costs some money. And they're starting to talk about repatriating some of their processing back into data centers. So what I'm going to predict is that we're going to see a lot more private clouds hosted on in internal data centers. We're going to interconnect with the public clouds. But people are going to be starting to choose where they run workloads. And I'm predicting a lot of organizations with sufficient technical skills are going to start running their own large language models, things like Llama and stuff, in their own private cloud on-prem, and only running that which they need to in the public clouds because the costs are going exponentially up. And one of the other things is, like OpenAI, I was looking at their numbers recently. So they basically spent $2.35 to make a dollar at the moment. They took $9 billion of investment recently and they've spent the lot.
And that's why they need the hype, because the sales have to continue to justify the
Yeah,
price. I mean,
it's not like a Ponzi scheme.
it is a little bit like a Ponzi scheme, and I encourage those who are being sold to ask questions. But I do think there's also a benefit beyond cost in that model, which is, smaller models that are tailor-made and ring-fence and supervised can often be far more effective as well as cheaper. This is the bit where, I had someone reach out this week and say, I know you're worried about catastrophic risks. I was like, no, I'm actually more worried about what's happening right now in the way that people are being harmed or that businesses are making poor decisions. And I think one of my other favorite quotes was it's also a C-suite exec who said, I wish that people in corporations would manage money like they manage their family budgets. Like, imagine if you came to your partner or your family and said, I want to spend all of this money on this new thing. The first question you'd ask would be, why? What's the problem that we have that we need to buy this thing for, right? And that's what you should be doing in corporations as well. What's our problem that we're trying to solve? And what's the cheapest, most stable, safest solution to do so? So starting from that point rather than whiz bang AI, open AI, selling hype. But I think we're getting there. I think more people are asking more questions than they were definitely even three, six, definitely more than 6 months ago.
But part of the problem is, it's been a perennial problem. It was a problem for me in 2000. My CEO at AMP went and played golf with a bunch of blokes and
Oh,
came back and said,
the golf sales.
we need to do e-commerce. And I was like, do you even know what e-commerce is, George? And he didn't have an idea. We didn't have a business need for it, but we did e-commerce because he had a whim. So management by whim has been with us for a while, will be with us for a long while. But organizations that can resist management by whim and start to systematize the prioritization of use cases, to systematize their what I'm calling the pipeline to production for AI, so proof of concept pilot to production. Organizations that can manage that effectively, they will start and can tie all of that to strategy will be the ones that start to win. So, if you're doing it on something on a whim, it's probably not going to stack up. There won't be broad support across the organization. And again, change management needs to be across all of that stuff. And typically, when you're running a project on a whim, you don't usually line up all the typical project resources. So, I think there's going to be some interesting winners and losers. So the people that can do that whole prioritization to production pipeline stuff well will do well. And the others that are just doing random stuff will just spend a lot of money. And all the cloud vendors will love them because
Just
they're
spending all the money.
endless revenue.
I'd say in addition to the whim, and I think we need to find another word out there. Maybe we just call it the whim purchase. I've always referred to them as the golf purchases, but maybe we need to reframe. I need to reframe my
We
language.
don't want to offend the golfers among us. There's a lot
There
of.
are golfers. Some of my best friends are golfers, Kate. I just want to make that very, very clear.
Yeah. I know many golfers and love them. I don't
We're
want to.
not judging golfers on this podcast. One of the other layers to that is I saw just this week someone announcing that they'd been to the Singularity University's executive program, and I'd say in addition to the whim purchases are also the strategic snake oil selling vendors. So there are trips that people take to Silicon Valley. There's the Singularity University, which by the way is not actually a university. People need to be skeptical and also ask questions about who's telling them what for what purpose. And I always talk about social silences, but what are the things that are not being said? Like, what's the cost? What's the environmental impact? What's the long-term sustainability of this project for your company versus, perhaps a slightly cheaper, simpler version? I think that educational push has become quite sophisticated in terms of almost like a contagion at some levels where people drink the Kool-Aid and then come back and say, well, everyone else thinks this is brilliant. It's like, well, you still need that culture where someone can put their tiny hand up and say, the emperor's got no clothes on, and here's why.
Yeah. Well, I genuinely think this is yet another thing in the technology space that's like teenage sex. A lot of people have fear of missing out. They think everybody's doing it, but
Yep.
a lot of people aren't geared up to be doing this. Only a small proportion of people have really got AI in production.
But they all talk about it as if they are, much like teenage sex as well. Yeah.
So I'm part of a global chief data officers forum. We meet a couple of times a year. And so generative AI has the shortest adoption curve I've ever seen. So we met in November last year. Nobody was touching it. No, everybody was trying to work out what it was and how they'd get value out of it. Met in Q1 this year. Everybody had at least a proof of concept in production. So that's the, and that was a whole lot of American and European banks included in that. So the shortest adoption curve from I don't know what to do with it, so I've got something in production. But they're all POCs in production. They're not really, and they may be scaled up POCs, but they haven't worked out how to make profit. They haven't worked out their cost models, and they haven't worked out how they manage risk across it and how they actually manage AI. So I think there's a big gap in organizations about the equivalent thing about application management, which we've been doing for many years. But for AI, because it's a kind of a mishmash of things. So some organizations will be having their own custom large language models, some will be using cloud-based AI technology. And one of the things that you're going to want is some kind of single pane of glass across all of that so that you can manage it properly. And boards are going to want to understand, well, what's my risk profile of all of this? So I can really see some gaps there.
I'm just in the process of drafting a two-pager for Australian boards because I think one of the biggest gaps is just most of the pieces of work I do are about being curious, about giving people the power to be able to ask questions, because there is such a hype and awe around these tools. And I've really enjoyed speaking to a room full of surgeons and doctors and nurses and cancer researchers who said, that's really helpful because it enables us to go into rooms and ask questions. I think people are hesitant. They're reluctant because they feel like they don't know something. And the more senior they are, the less likely they are to necessarily want to ask or feel safe to ask. And again, just empowering people and giving people the right questions to ask, because these tools actually embed your company values and strategy. And I think that's something that boards also need to understand, that when you make some of these choices, they're not just operational, they're also quite strategic. And where that operational versus strategic divide is quite complex. But being able to ask those questions to have that information is really, really important. Yeah,
Yeah.
there's so much work to be done in this space. It's definitely
Yeah.
there's an enormous hunger.
There's the board space, which you've just spoken about, but then there's the understanding for the executives, because like when we're talking about AI, what do we mean? Do we mean generative AI? Do we mean agentic AI? Do we mean deep learning? Do we mean neural networks? Like, what do we mean? Do we just mean large language models, or is something else? Is it machine learning? All of these things, and they're the questions people need to be empowered to ask. Like, what specific technology do you actually mean when you use this umbrella of AI?
Or is it a control F function? I always say, AI needs to be, and Leslie Seebeck wrote a lovely blog on this as well about the AI definition. My favorite one is actually from 2004. The Administrative Review Council talks to experts about expert systems. So the Australian government did some great work back in the early 2000s, long time ago, that if something's nudging something else to make a decision or is providing input, that's from a legal perspective, you've got it's sort of an administrative role there. You've got administrative law that comes into, decision making play. So RoboDebt was a spreadsheet. It actually doesn't really matter, and you're allowed to ask, to your point. And also, a little bit like the teenage sex equivalent, everyone calls it AI until it works, and then it's not AI anymore. AI is a sales pitch to get it through the door. But what is it really? And being able to ask those questions and realize that, everyone needs to be asking these questions at each level to know what to do properly, to manage these systems properly, is really important. But yes, I could go on for hours. There's so much work that's needed and so much appetite for that work. I think that anyone who wants to work in this space will have endless amounts of work going forward.
Indeed. And that seems like a good place for us to draw this to a close. Thanks for your time, Kobe. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
Lovely to talk. And I love how much the work that I'm doing just opens up more of the work that is needed from you. It's completely symbiotic.
Thank you. Bye.
And that is it for another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. I'm Kate Crothers. Thank you so much for listening. Please don't forget to give the show a nice review and a like on your podcast app of choice. See you next time.